Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the show. This is Sports Takeover on RMU Radio. Matt and Chris with you as always. Let's get started. The Masters just concluded this weekend, and it was a tournament for the ages, Chris. Tiger Woods is back on top. The top of the leaderboard was incredibly packed. It was absolutely a fantastic event. What were your thoughts?
What were my thoughts? Tiger Woods is back. That's very odd. Also, sorry for that initial sound you heard. It was me slapping my hand off the mic. So great introduction into the show. But yeah, Tiger Woods coming back. It's just phenomenal for the sport of golf and for him. So he won the Masters this Sunday. He finished 13 under, which beat Xander Schauffele, Brooks Koepka, and Dustin Johnson by one stroke. Going into Sunday, he was actually down two strokes to Francesco Molinari. So this is actually the first of all 15 of his majors that he had not been either tied for the lead or leading going into Sunday. So from that standpoint, it's just a good win in itself for him to actually come back and win the major. When you look at all the different parts to it, you have to unravel to see how much this means to him and to golf. It really is outstanding. It's his 15th major victory overall, and it's been 11 years since he won his last one. It was the 2008 U.S. Open when he had that incredible playoff against, I believe, Rocco Mediate it was. So it's been forever since he was on top, but he's back on top once again. He has that nice green jacket.
Yeah, and it's been even longer since he claim that green jacket. It's incredible when you think about Tiger Woods, because I feel like for me, he's the golfer that we've grown up with. But it's funny to think that his dominance began before we were even born. 1997 was his first Masters. For as relevant as he's been for the entire 21 years that I've been alive, the fact that his success goes the whole way back to before we were born just blows my mind. But 97, 01, 02, and 05 are his other four Masters titles. Incredible to think he was that dominant for that long and then dropped off the whole way until 2019. Not dropped off. He's played good golf throughout that time. But, of course, what he's gone through in between those Masters is incredible. He's the second oldest player ever to win the Masters. You mentioned it, two strokes back to start the final round. And we all know about the off-course scandals. There was a DUI, the back surgeries, everything you can imagine for Tiger. He was ranked 1,199th at one point in 2017.
I hear I was ranked 1,200th at that same time, actually.
I don't think that's quite true, but it's fun to think about, isn't it?
He was that far away.
No one knows who's on the list at that point, but miraculously it was Tiger Woods.
Exactly.
He is now number six, which is much more fitting with the Tiger Woods that we've seen recently. Fun fact about this event, somebody bet $85,000 on Tiger to win prior to the event, paid out $1.19 million.
If you have $85,000 to bet, you're not really worried about what the payout is, but congratulations for making that payout. Maybe you can do some more stupid bets with it, but man, that's a lot.
Kind of incredible. The whole tournament was incredible. You talked about who was right there at 12 under. Tiger was at 13 under. At 11 under, Tony Finau, Webb Simpson, Francisco Molinari, and Jason Day. So unbelievably
it was
tight.
Jam-packed at the top.
Yes, it was. And then tied at ninth, John Rahm, Ricky Fowler, and Patrick Cantlay at 10 under. So everybody was right there. Ricky was your guy. You picked to win. I picked Rory. He finished tied for 21st at 5 under. Not a bad tournament, but not really in contention, given how many guys were at the top of that leaderboard.
Yeah, most certainly. And the one interesting thing about Sunday's final round was, because there was concerns of weather, they actually started the round in the morning, because typically, the final round will start, what, they'll start about 2 o'clock or so?
Probably,
3 o'clock, and then they'll go on till about, I don't know, 6 o'clock or so. But because there was impending weather late in the day, they actually had to start in the morning. So the tournament itself was over, I think, before 3 o'clock even.
Yeah.
Which is kind of different when you're, you know, you go through a routine, you're like, all right, you know, Thursday is kind of early tee off, Friday maybe early, but then Saturday and Sunday, once you start to establish yourself as one of the leaders, you're getting later and later in the day, kind of getting your routine. Obviously, Tiger has been in this place many times before, so I'm sure he had a similar routine in these years before that he did this year, but kind of alters a little bit, which ended up paying dividends for him as Molinari shot two over and he shot the two under to counteract that 1-2 displacement at the top. You said that the guy made so much money on the bet. He had 14-1 odds to win to Tiger Woods, which was third best, so he wasn't exactly written off going into it. People had a very good idea that he was going to compete, but I don't know if anybody could have predicted that he would win, especially in the way that he did, though.
You're right. It was a fantastic tournament. Certainly, the talk recently has been whether or not Tiger's back, because we've seen him play. He took some time off after, again, his back was not cooperating with him.
Four different surgeries on that.
Yeah, incredible, the injuries that he's overcome. And obviously, you can imagine, whether you're a golfer or not, trying to swing a club for 18 holes with a bad back is probably, that might be the worst injury you can have as a golfer. That's horrible. But he's overcome it. For his legacy, Do you think he continues to build on it? Is he back? Where are we at now with Tiger? Because everyone's going to say Tiger's back. He had a good year last year. But at the same time, he is older. Are we jumping to conclusions? Are we just telling ourselves what we want to hear? Or is Tiger back?
So he's not exactly going to be the same athlete he was back in the early 2000s when it was basically Tiger versus the field every weekend. But he is certainly here, I think, to stay and compete at the PGA Tour level, probably for at least this year and the next year. So with his major victory, he's at 15 now. That puts him 3 behind Jack Nicklaus for first all time. On the other side of it, which is less talked about, PGA Tour wins overall, he's now at 81, which is only one behind Sam Snead for first overall. So that is definitely a title that I think he can attain possibly even this year. Just needs two more wins to have sole possession of first place overall, which is incredible. Like you said, you look at how many times he either missed cuts or had to withdraw or couldn't even put himself into events just because of how much pain he was in, couldn't do it. I think he's back for sure. Now, he is 43. It's obviously on the latter end of the spectrum of ages of people that are going to be in their prime in golf. He is no longer in his prime, but considering he was the best golfer in the world, I don't think him coming back and doing what he's doing now is a flash in the pan. I think it probably is here to sustain and can be sustainable for sure.
Yeah, you make some really good points, and I would agree. The overall win total, I think he definitely surpasses. The major total that Jack Nicklaus has at 18.
It's a tough one.
I don't think he's gonna beat that or match that, and like you said, it's not him against the field like it used to be. There are some fantastic golfers week in and week out there at the top of the leaderboard, and when you only have four majors a year, I think that just becomes more difficult to attain. I do agree though, I think he's back. I think this is for real, and I think this just speaks volumes about what kind of athlete and what kind of golfer he is, because we saw him so dominant in the early 2000s. Everything, you know, kind of falls apart for him. No one knows whether he's going to come back, and he wins the Tour Championship in the fall. Here he is now, a Masters champion in the spring. I think Tiger's back. I think he's going to be competitive week in and week out, and I think that this is absolutely fantastic for golf. Golf goes as Tiger goes. Tiger's back. This is great for golf.
Yeah, the one thing I saw today when I was reading through some stats about him, whenever Tiger plays in tournaments, the average of all the other golfers is one under par better than if he wasn't in the tournament. So when he plays, the people he plays against try harder
Very
too.
Interesting.
Whether it's been, like there was a time several years ago when his father passed away, he took off, I believe, a month or two from it. We saw the averages rise a little bit. And then obviously throughout all the surgeries and stuff, yes, there are good players in golf. You know, Phil Mickelson's there, Rory McIlroy's there. But Tiger Woods is the face of golf as far as, you know, as long as he's still at an age where he can compete at the PGA Tour. While he's there, everybody else says, all right, Tiger's in the field. I want to beat Tiger. I mean, how many of these people he's playing against right now are people that were rooting for him whenever they were growing up watching golf, having played for 20 years? Surely a certain amount of people in the field have, you know, started out age 10 or whatever when they're falling in love with the game because of Tiger. Now they're getting the chance to compete against the guy they used to watch. It's great. I think he's back. One more question about it. Is this the greatest comeback in sports?
Boy, it's up there.
I think individually it has to be.
I would say so. I just think for as dominant as he once was, and for as dramatic as the fallout was, and then the long road back, I mean, when you look at his list of majors, you said a 2008 is where you leave off, and then all of a sudden you jump to 2019. He was so dominant for that stretch of time, and then you take that stretch of time again, and it's empty.
It's 11 years. There's 44 majors about in that time span.
And it's not that it was just one thing for him, that it was just the back injury that just wouldn't leave him alone. It wasn't just one DUI that kind of derailed things. It was a combination of things for a long time and serious things. But Tiger's still as popular as ever, still important for golf. I'm excited to see what the future holds for Tiger.
Yeah, I think it's really close to being up there. Michael Jordan coming back and to win three more championships after playing baseball and stepping away from NBA is up there too with greatest of individual comebacks. But
again, that's a two-year hiatus.
Right, not in
11.
And it's not like he's been gone for 11 years. He's been gone from the main scene. I mean, he's been trying. It all started in 2008 with that major victory. He tore his ACL actually in that event that he won. That kind of set all the dominoes into effect. But he's back. He's not better than ever, but he's definitely here to stay. So big congratulations to Tiger Woods for sure on his Masters victory for 2019. Moving ahead now, MLB. We're about a month into the season, about 3 weeks, so definitely some storylines here and there. We're going to first talk about some extensions that have happened because who doesn't love money going around? I'm sure these players do. We're going to start with the St. Louis Cardinals. It is Matt Carpenter. He received a two-year, $39 million extension, which that's a lot of money for Matt Carpenter, but he did finish ninth last year in the MVP voting with a 36 home run season. Is this good for the Cardinals? Is it bad? What are your thoughts?
I think it's good for the Cardinals. I mean, he's been there for a long time. That's kind of a staple of your organization. And I'm going to keep coming back to it. We've talked about the gigantic sums of money that have been dished out in recent months. This is not one of those contracts. I think when you can sign a seasoned veteran for a reasonable amount of money, I don't think there's too much risk there for the Cardinals to keep a guy who has been a critical part of your organization for quite some time. So I like it. I think it's fine.
Yeah, definitely. And $40 million, while it may be a lot over 2 years, he is a lot more to the team than what his numbers say.
Right.
I mean, he is essentially the St. Louis Cardinals now. When you look at it, it's not Albert Pujols' team. I don't know if it's quite Matt Carpenter's team, but he is as much the face of the team, I think, as anybody else could be.
Yeah, I think when you think of the St. Louis Cardinals, one of the first players that comes to mind, if not the first player that comes to mind, is Matt Carpenter.
Right, so keeping him there for two more years, certainly good. And another player that's going to be sticking around with our team for a few more years is Ozzie Albies, second baseman of the Atlanta Braves, signed a seven-year, $35 million extension. Last year, which was his first full season, he was an all-star with 24 home runs and 72 RBIs. What do you make of this extension?
A little bit surprising that a guy who has, I mean, he sees this money going around too, but at the same time, you want to take what you can get right now. I think it's fantastic for the Braves. You're getting a player who's only ever been an all-star, obviously only one try at it, but he was fantastic in his first full year. Very manageable contract, even more manageable than the Matt Carpenter contract. For Albies, could he have gotten more money farther down the road? Yeah, absolutely, as long as he continues to play like he did last year. But $35 million is nothing to shake a stick at. So
I think it's kind of a ripoff for him, though. He is making $5 million a year, whereas his teammate Ronald Acuna signed the eight-year, $100 million. Now, Acuna, yes, he is, I guess, a better player than Albies. I mean, he did win Rookie of the Year last year. Different positions, but Albies is by no means a bad second baseman. I mean, if you can hit 24 home runs, if you hit 20 home runs at second base, you're good. 24, 72 RBIs, your first full year with the team, that's great. He's a speedster. Him and Acuna are going to be good with the team for a while. I just think he probably could have gotten more than only $5 million a year. It seems very, very team-friendly, because if you look at it this way, he has about 3 to 4 years while the team controls him through the pre-arbitration, arbitration, whatever. After that point, he can probably make at least $10 million a year if he's still keeping up this pace, so I guess he wants to stay with the Braves. I don't know. Maybe it's just a situation of being a little bit young and naive, possibly.
Maybe. And again, it could just be taking the safe route. I mean, you get $35 million thrown in front of you. I mean, it's a matter, I guess, of whether or not you want to take that chance on yourself. And
that's
it's
true.
Not that he didn't want to take the chance on himself, but, you know, you make whatever he would have had this year, take your chances and hope for $10 million next year, or take five this year and, you know, make do with $35 million. I think it's certainly surprising, but when you think about it strictly from a personal standpoint or financial standpoint and don't compare it to what's going on around him, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, definitely does. Some notable player headlines now from the first 3 weeks. Christian Yelich and Cody Bellinger, they apparently want the NL MVP race to start immediately, as both have done nothing but crush the ball. Both have 9 home runs. Yelich has 25 RBIs to Bellinger's 23, which is remarkable.
That's incredible.
We're 3 weeks into the season.
Portion of the season. That's wild.
Yeah. Yelich is hitting .357 with a .446 on base and a .246 on base and slugging. Bellinger is only hitting a mere .433, which is insane. .513 on base. He gets on base more than half the time he comes up to the dish. It's ridiculous. And his OPS is .1438. So these guys have done nothing but mash the ball. Christian Yelich had a 3-home run game against the Cardinals the other night. I believe he has 8 against them on the season, 7. It's a lot. He's
wow.
Done remarkable. Mike Trout's another guy that I would like to highlight. While he did have a small injury, that didn't stop him from going with 5 home runs and 12 RBIs. .368 average. Oh, and he's on base 569% of the time, which is even more incredible than Cody Bellinger's mark, and he has a .385 OPS, so definitely some sluggers here. Anybody you want to highlight?
Oh, Chris, you want to talk about a slugger. Chris Davis.
I'm glad you bring him up.
Started the season 0-54. Holy cow. That's horrible.
Done that.
That's awful. 0-54. He has since turned things on a little bit. Multi-hit game, some home runs. A home run, 2 home runs?
At least one.
Either way, he has a home run now, which is more than you can say about his hit total at this time last week. Not a bad player in his career. Last year was a struggle for him. The year before was very good. I don't know what we're looking at with Chris Davis anymore, but 0 for 54, thank goodness it came to an end is all I can say.
The funny part is he went 3 for 5 in that game. Actually, he got his first hit, 4 RBIs. It was against the Red Sox of all teams.
The Red Sox are dead last in their division.
Matt, the Red Sox are in trouble.
The Red Sox are blowing my mind.
Chris Sale has a 0-4 record with an 850 ERA. Rick Porcello, former Cy Young winner for the Red Sox, right? 0-3 with an 11.12 ERA. What's going on with him?
I don't have the slightest idea. And in 162 games, I'm not that worried about it yet. We've talked about this. I'm not that worried about it yet. But those are not good numbers.
No, I mean, first, second week, maybe you can excuse it. But they're 6-12. I mean, at this point in the season, you know, are you going to start getting it together yet? I mean, Chris Sale leads the league in losses. 850 ERA is fourth. I believe you have him on your fantasy team, and he's done nothing but get negative point totals for you.
That is unfortunately correct.
I mean, it's not the Chris Sale that we've seen. His velocity was up in last night's game, but the Yankees just said, I don't care what your velocity is. I'm still going to hit their ball all over the field. It's insane.
And to be dead last in the division at this stage of the season is one thing, but the team in second place in the AL East is the New York Yankees at 7-9. This, by no means, is a division that has excelled through the first few weeks of the season, so that makes this even a little bit more concerning.
But one team in that division that has excelled is the best team in baseball. No, not the Yankees, not the Red Sox, not the Baltimore Orioles, not the Blue Jays, all of which have made ALCSs recently. It's the Tampa Bay Rays, who sit at a 13-4 record with a +40 run differential. And one of the guys that is spearheading that is former Pirate Tyler Glasnow, 4-0 record on the season with a 1.13 ERA. His 4-0 mark leads the league. His ERA is top five in the league. There are some interesting things going on in the AL East for sure when you look at what Glasnow and Austin Meadows is having a great season too. He has 6 home runs, 12 RBIs, and he's hitting about .350, which we didn't see that on the Pirates all the last season, which I don't think that either of these two guys were given nearly enough time or credit to do anything.
No, I agree.
But it's good on the Rays for doing what they're doing right now.
Yeah, it's fantastic for the Rays. And not only do you have these young guys playing well, but as a team, you're performing well. Not only do they have the best record in baseball, they have a 5.5 game lead over the second place Yankees already. So, I mean, if nothing else, you're building a nice cushion here through the first couple weeks of the season.
Yeah, some other teams are building nice cushions. The Houston Astros are only a half game up on the surprising Seattle Mariners, but that's because they are on the heels of a 10-game win streak after starting the season 2-5. The Astros are back to the form that we all expected them to be. Alex Bregman, Carlos Correa, Jose Altuve all are doing excellent things to lead the Astros to the top of their division. And the Central is the Cleveland Indians, but I think that, like we've said pretty much for like the last 6 months, it's only the Cleveland Indians in the Central. The NL, a little bit more interesting, but still as predictable as I think we had thought early in the season. Milwaukee leads the Central, Philadelphia in the East. In the West is the Dodgers. Once again, the Miami Marlins sit at 4-14, the worst team in all of baseball.
Yeah, so as far as who's at the top of these divisions in the National League, I don't think it's surprising. To me, what's surprising is the teams that are right behind them. The Phillies are at 10-6. Half a game back are the New York Mets, who I didn't think would be that close. Again, early in the season, but that's a little bit surprising to me. A game and a half behind the Brewers are the second-place Pittsburgh Pirates of all teams
in
the Central. Again, early, but still a little bit surprising. And then the Padres and Dodgers are both at 11-8, 2 games behind them, the Arizona Diamondbacks, who we both have expressed our lack of enthusiasm about for this season. So it'll be interesting to see if some of these teams that are within reach right now will be within reach, say, a month from now. I don't know that they will be, but it's kind of exciting to see. Early in the season is always fun when teams are surprising you all over the place, and we're seeing a little bit of that.
Yeah, and two of those teams you mentioned, the Pirates and the Padres, can thank some great pitchers for the reasons why they're at the top. The leader in ERA amongst the AL and NL is Joe Musgrove of the Pittsburgh Pirates. He has a .81 ERA, but don't worry, the Pirates are up to their usual antics, and he has a 1-1 record to match that .81
Isn't
ERA.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah, he'd had a .0 ERA up until his last start when he finally gave up some runs, but thankfully for his sake, the Pirates can only muster up one win while he starts. And for the Padres, Kirby Yates leads the entire league in saves. He is 9-for-9 on saves with a .9 ERA. If you had told me that Kirby Yates would be leading the ERA or the saves from closers in the league, I would have said, for what team, because Kirby Yates to me is nobody of mass importance, but apparently to the Padres, he is hugely successful and part of the reason why they are currently in second.
The other exciting thing about the beginning of the season are the players that you expect something from and don't get, or that you don't expect something from and you do get, and that's what you're seeing in some of these guys in Tampa Bay and some of these guys in the National League. It's interesting, and again, it'll be exciting to see how long they can keep that up.
Yeah, definitely. So moving ahead, some great NBA playoff has happened. Interesting series beginnings, I think. We really saw the NBA mostly as a top-heavy race, but some of the lower seeds have decided to think otherwise. I'm going to start in the West with the 1-8 matchup, the Warriors and the Clippers.
Oh, boy.
It's the Warriors, right, Matt? They're going to go
4-0,
4-1. It'll be easy.
Put 3-1 in the same sentence, and they disagree.
I'm going to, because the other night against the Clippers, they were up 31 points, and everybody had pretty much gone to bed that was either a Clippers fan or a fan of basketball, because in what world does Golden State blow a 31-point lead? Well, the same world they blew a 3-1 lead, as the Clippers were able to storm back and beat the Warriors by a score of 135-131. What happened?
That's a fantastic question. I think when you are so good, you reach a point that you look down on the rest of the league and the rest of the teams you play. I'm not in the locker room. I don't know that, nor do I follow the Warriors close enough to know that. But to me, you're looking at a team that has had it pretty easy for the most part in the last 4 years and probably took this Clippers team for granted in this situation. Now, does that excuse a 31-point lead being blown? Absolutely not. I don't care who you're playing or in what situation or what your mindset is. You shouldn't blow that lead.
Largest in playoff history.
Coming from one of the best teams, dynasties in postseason history. So I don't know how this happened. I can only think that they didn't take the Clippers seriously in that moment and somehow let that get away from them.
The one key thing is that Patrick Beverley, he's a guard for the Clippers. He's not going to put up 20 points a night for you, but he's also preventing Kevin Durant from putting up 30. He is getting under Kevin Durant's skin so well. It reminds me of whenever Lance Stephenson and LeBron were going at years ago.
Yep.
If everybody remembers when Stephenson blew into LeBron's ear, that's essentially what Beverley is doing with Durant. They both got technicals the other night, and Beverley said, "I got there to try to be the best defender on the court." Well, I think Kevin Durant would agree that he is doing so thus far. Do I see this being long-term success for the Clippers? No. Is it certainly a worrying sign for the Warriors? A little bit. Whether you blow a 31-point lead in the regular season or the postseason, it's not good. Postseason just amplifies it because there's a bigger target on you now. More eyes are focused your way, especially when you're the team that, okay, you know, they're going to go to the finals once again. I don't think that they're going to lose to the Clippers, but 31 points certainly is a very wide margin of victory to have go down, and only your second game, and it being a home game too.
Yeah, I'm not concerned about the Warriors moving forward, but if they don't come into game three with some urgency and look like they want to be there, I think you're going to start to wonder a little bit at least what's going on in their heads, what's going on in that locker room.
There are some other upper seeds that you have to kind of wonder what's going on in their heads. Denver Nuggets are the 2 seed. Toronto Raptors are the 2 seed. Philadelphia 76ers are the 3 seed. All three of these teams lost their first game at home. They did end up winning the second game at home, so all three of these series are tied. But Denver dropped one to the Spurs, Philadelphia dropped one to the Nets, and Toronto dropped one to the Orlando Magic. DJ Augustine is a guy that I had not heard of in probably about 9 years. He put up 25 points for the Magic in game one, because the point guard on the other side of the court, Kyle Lowry, put up 0 points, went 0-for-7 from the field. In last night's game two, Lowry is able to put up 22. Augustine came back down to earth and only put up about 10. So falling in the line of what we would expect, but what do you take away from these lower seeds stealing game one from all these higher seeds?
So very surprising in all of them. In the East, first of all, Toronto and Philadelphia I'm not too concerned with because I liked their answer. Both of their game ones were close. 104-101, Toronto lost to Orlando. 111-102, Philadelphia lost to Brooklyn. So that's not bad. Not what you want, but it's not bad. In game two, Toronto comes back and wins 111-82.
Decisive victory.
They got the message. They took care of business. Game two, the 76ers drop 145 points, 51 of which came in the third quarter. I would say that they also got the message.
And that's 145 in regulation.
Right.
That's a ridiculous amount.
Right. So seeing the answer to me is always the important part. The answer was good from both of those teams. The answer from the Nuggets, not as convincing. It was 114-105. A 9-point win I mean, it's what you needed. You're back to 1-1 in the series. It's a best of five from here. But San Antonio, we've talked about, is fantastic at home, horrible on the road. So to drop one at home to this team is a little disappointing. Now you have to go into their place where they are 32-9.
Yeah, that's hard to stay.
Now suddenly they have home court advantage. That kind of makes me lean a little bit more towards the Spurs. So I got to see something from Denver in either game three or game four.
Yeah, in game two, the Spurs were actually up going into the fourth quarter. The Nuggets had a very good fourth quarter, spearheaded by Jamal Murray. He has had a very good year, so has Nikola Jokic. Neither have really been talked about very much because nobody cares about the Nuggets now that Carmelo's gone, but the Spurs definitely had the game in control. Denver, they are the better team of the two. Don't get that wrong. But the fact that they had to come back from after already losing the first game is dangerous for them. You said the Spurs are great at home. So assuming that the home teams win, the Spurs will go up 3-1. Denver will win game five. They go 3-2. Then it goes back to San Antonio, which there's no guarantee that Denver is going to be able to win there on the road.
Right, and you're looking at two teams that have single-digit losses at home and a losing record on the road. I only picked the Nuggets in this series because they were going to have more home games. Well, they've dropped home court. They have to steal it back. I'm not convinced necessarily that they're going to do it. Spurs look good on the road, and that surprises me.
And you can never count out a Greg Popovich coach team.
You're right.
People say, oh, it's Steve Kerr, and they talk about other coaches, but Greg Popovich is still the best coach, I think, of the NBA history. And the fact that he has a seven-seeded Spurs where people don't count them out is just incredible for them. Another series that is going not necessarily as I expected, but I guess as playoff seeding would expect, is the Portland and OKC series. Portland is the 3, OKC is the 6, and Portland has a 2-0 lead, mostly because of what Damian Lillard has done. He put up 30 points in Game 1, followed by 29 points in Game 2. His counterpart, Russell Westbrook, not so hot from the field. Between both games, he only went 13 for 37. That's about a 33-35%. So Lillard is certainly leading Portland very well, which surprises both of us, seeing how OKC has dominated Portland in recent years.
Yeah, and leave it to us to pick one upset in the first round. Both of us picked the same one, and it's the only series right now in the playoffs that's 2-0.
Yeah, there are three that are 1-0 because NBA likes to take multiple days off, apparently. But
it's just kind of funny the way that works out. But no, there has to be an answer from the Thunder. And I stressed the road performance of these teams when I was making my picks. They're good on the road. At least comparatively. So the fact that they don't come away with any here is surprising. Obviously, they have to take one at home. They have to. But ideally, they need both. Regardless, they need to find a way in Game 5 to get that road performance working a little bit and make this more of a series going forward.
Yeah, and don't fault Paul George. He has been trying as hard as possible. While Westbrook is doing well, it still comes down to him. He needs to be the guy that leads this team. He is as much the Thunder as anybody else is. And whenever Damian Lillard is outplaying him on the other side of the ball, it's really hard to see the Thunder being able to pose such a threat. If they can contain Lillard and Westbrook can start to play the game that he wants to play, good things will come from OKC. But as it stands right now, good things will not come for them.
Yeah, another series here that's kind of off to a strange start. Boston and Indiana in the East.
Kind of a boring start.
Boston's up 1-0 after an 84-74 victory. What the heck is that? I don't think any other team in the entire postseason is going to be able to win a game with 84 points. I mean, we've read some of these other scores, and 84 points gets you a 30-point loss. That's incredible to me. Currently, in the third quarter, that game is in favor. Game two is in favor of the Pacers, 62-58. Another close one, not overly high scoring in itself. There is still 9 minutes to go, roughly, in the third, but not huge scores there either. So just interesting to see how that one's playing out.
Yeah, definitely. We thought Boston would have that series mostly just because Victor Oladipo's not there. I guess without him there, nobody wants to score, but it's a 4-5, so it really could go either way still. Clearly, the Pacers have the small advantage right now. A 10-point loss at that small of a margin of points, too, is not really that monumental, in my opinion. Milwaukee Bucks, they're taking care of business. They won their first game, 121-86. Detroit looked like they were a team that does not belong in the playoffs, and for good reason. I mean, it's ridiculous amount of victory. Right now, the Bucks are already up 31-20 in the first quarter. Seems like the Bucks are going to roll over this series rather easily. And the last series to discuss is the Houston and Utah series, where Houston was able to take game one once again, as people would have expected. But it's still a huge margin of victory. It's 122-90. So in these first few games, we have seen some big margins of victory for sure.
Yeah, that Milwaukee series, game one, they outscored Detroit 38-18 in the first quarter. So I guess if they have 20, they're already off to a better start there. You talked about the Houston blowout, 39-19 in favor of the Rockets in the fourth quarter. And just bouncing back to the Celtics and the Pacers real quick. Third quarter the other night, the Pacers had 8 points. They currently have 12, so they're in business, I suppose, as we speak.
Yeah, I guess so. Some of these series are definitely going in the favor of the teams we have expected, but it's been an interesting start, to say the least, to the NBA playoffs for sure. For right now, though, we are going to take a break, but coming up, there's a lot to discuss in the NHL. Boy, oh boy, did a lot happen in the first short week of the playoffs, so please stay tuned.
Welcome back to Sports Takeover. Matt and Chris, we are going to move from the NBA playoffs to the NHL playoffs. But before we get there, we have a couple coaches to announce, Chris.
Yes, we love all the coaches that have been fired in the regular season. Now it's time to go to the coaches that have been hired in the postseason. We're going to start with the LA Kings, making an interesting hire, not really one that I care too much for. They have hired Todd McClellan, former coach of the Oilers and the Sharks. With the Sharks, he led them to a President's Trophy in 2008-09, which was his first season with the team. Led them to two conference finals in a row, which they lost both of. Edmonton, he joined after the Sharks had some disappointing years, and he brought them only more disappointment. Made the playoffs once in a three-year span, making no conference finals. Was fired earlier this season. I guess it's an okay hire for the Kings. I really don't know what to make of that one too much.
It's a little underwhelming. He did win a Stanley Cup in 2008 with the Detroit Red Wings as an assistant coach. Obviously different than being a head coach, but there is that championship experience there. Regular season, he's got 434 wins in 806 games, so that's not a fantastic win percentage.
About half.
You know, what you talked about is kind of some missed expectations. Obviously, he had some fantastic regular season success with the Sharks, couldn't quite get over the hump. And then this Edmonton team is very talented and hasn't been able to get the job done. So I don't know. I'm like you. I'm not totally sure what to think. I don't think the answers are there in terms of talent for the Kings anyway.
Not in the slightest.
So regardless of what happens next year, I don't think that who your coach is necessarily makes the difference in terms of, you know, are we in the lottery or are we trying to win a Stanley Cup? But yeah, it'll be interesting to see if he's a long-term answer there.
Yeah, because the Kings, like you said, the answer is not within their coach. Their players are old. We've talked about many times this year, they're just not built right now for what the league is built for, which it's fine. They won their cups. You know, teams go through recession periods after doing well. The Kings just aren't doing well right now. Yeah. But for the lack of success, he was able to bring Edmonton with people like Connor McDavid, Leon Draisaitl.
That's what concerns me.
Yeah, that's what concerns me too, because they had one good season, but still could be considered underwhelming by some, seeing how they didn't make the conference finals. We thought, okay, they made, you know, the second round of the playoffs, are going to do well in the future. Well, Todd McClellan said, hold on, I don't think that's going to happen. I don't know how long-term a solution is for the Kings, but at least for the beginning of the next season, he will be the solution for them. One coach that I think is a long-term solution, which I think is a good hire, comes, unfortunately, to our rival, the Philadelphia Flyers. It is Alain Vigneault. He is a guy that we have seen very much as Penguins fans. He used to be the coach of the Rangers, previously was the coach of the Canucks as well, and his resume is certainly excellent. He won back-to-back President's Trophies with the Canucks in the 2010-11 and the 2011-12 seasons. Made the Stanley Cup the first year, lost the Bruins, trashed the city, not his fault. Then when he went to the Rangers, he only took them to the Stanley Cup the first year he was with them and won the President's Trophy in the 2014-15 season. He's the winningest coach in Canucks history, so he's certainly a guy that has a resume that can speak for itself.
Yeah, similar to McClellan, he's a guy who hasn't quite been able to get over the hump, but he's had more success doing it than McClellan has. As you said, he's participated in the Stanley Cup Finals twice, is a coach of the year. He has coached in 1,216 games in the regular season, 139 in the playoffs. So certainly he's got the experience and probably the most experience of any coach the Flyers could have hoped to hire, not named Quenneville, but obviously that ship has sailed. Also, eight times in his career, his teams have put together 100-plus point seasons in the regular season. So certainly for a Philadelphia Flyers team that appears to have the talent on the roster, having a coach like this, you would think, is what they need to get them there, especially if a Carter Hart can prove to be the answer in goal. I think should things go well for the Flyers, have some good fortune, maybe make a nice addition in the offseason, this could be a team to watch out for come this time next year.
Yeah, certainly. Obviously, Vigneault has had success. Like I said, led the Rangers to the Stanley Cup Final in his first season with the team. He knows how to get teams to the playoffs, obviously. 139 games is a lot. It's over a season's worth of playoffs, so that's remarkable in itself. And you said the Flyers do have the pieces. I agree with you. They still have a very strong core of Giroux, of Voracek. They have Shane Gostisbehere on the blue line. Carter Hart seems to be the solution in net, which, like we've said earlier in the show, it's been a problem for the Flyers for years. They have not had a good goalie since...
Oh, boy. I don't even know if I could tell you the last time that they had a solid number one, no doubt, hands-down goalie.
I mean, they've had people they've called their number one, but none of them have starting job except for Sergei Bobrovsky, who they gave up on.
Put it this way. If you look at the teams that have won cups recently, they have a go-to goaltender. The Flyers have not had that at any point in that span.
And now that they have Vigneault paired with Hart, this is a team that can make noise. Will they their first year? I'm not certain because they're still new coach. They might need a few more pieces. They did let Wayne Simmonds go through the trade market back at the deadline, so he was a staple of the team for a while, but I think that they do have the pieces to certainly contend in the division. Whether they will this year, I don't know, but certainly moving forward, Vigneault seems to be a very smart hire as far as the Flyers are concerned.
The framework is there for them to be a playoff team next year. They just have to do a couple more minor things between now and then.
Those are the hires. Now to get on to what matters most right now in the NHL, the playoffs. Some interesting series, some shocking series. We'll get to those last. We're going to go over the ones that are still currently...
Save the best for last.
That's right. I'm going to start in the West. It is with Nashville and Dallas. Currently, Nashville has a 2-1 lead in the series. All games have been only by a margin of victory of one goal. So this series, I believe I said seven games. Did you say seven as well?
Yeah, for Dallas.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, we both said Dallas in seven in this one, so we thought it was going to be extraordinarily close. Clearly, these teams believe it's going to be extraordinarily close. What's going on in the game right now? I believe they're playing.
Oh, my. Nashville's doing a whole lot of nothing. Dallas has three goals. We have a 3-0 game, roughly a little bit over halfway through the first period. Dallas has as many shots, as many goals as Nashville has shots. So certainly a fantastic start for the Stars there, trying to even the series.
Yeah, 100%. It seems that this series is going back and forth extraordinarily well. Another series in the West that's going back and forth very well is Winnipeg and St. Louis. They are tied at 2-2 because apparently nobody likes playing on home ice.
Well, yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah, St. Louis was able to go up 2-0 on the road in Winnipeg against a whiteout, which many people, including myself, would have wrote Winnipeg off. So what did Winnipeg do? They came back and won the next two games to tie up the series 2-2. Game three was, I believe, a 3-goal margin of victory. Game four was an overtime game where they only won by one, obviously much closer now, but this series could go either way still, I think, too.
Yeah, and you said about the 3-goal margin in Game 3. Every other game has been decided by one goal. So very even, arguably the most even series to this point. And it'll be interesting.
Only one that's tied, technically.
Right, and it'll be interesting to see what happens in Game 5.
100%. Another series going, I think you would have thought this much more than I would have. It's the Colorado Avalanche versus the Calgary Flames. The Flames were my pick out of the West to make the Cup. They were the one seed. They won. Had the best record in the West. Definitely a good team. They won game one via a shutout from Mike Smith. Okay, this is the team that is going to win the series in 4 or 5 games. Well, it's going to have to be at least 6 because Colorado currently possesses a 2-1 lead in the series. What is going on with the Avalanche and the Flames, Matt?
It's all about the Stars. Nathan MacKinnon.
No, the Avalanche and the Flames,
Dallas Stars. No, Chris, the star power, the skaters that are on the ice. Nathan MacKinnon at one point in the series had 3 consecutive goals. He is a fantastic player who can take over a game. That's exactly what he did at the end of Game 2 and what he did at the beginning of Game 3. Johnny Gaudreau on the other side.
Johnny Hockey.
A young player that I like a lot. 1 point to this juncture of the series.
Ooh, that's not going to get the job
right.
done.
These are two players that their teams go as they go, and we're going to need a little bit more from Johnny Gaudreau. The Flames are going to make a comeback here. Big game tonight. They play at 10 o'clock. Calgary's got to try to even this thing up.
I wouldn't count out the Flames. Certainly Colorado has played very well, but like you said, it kind of goes as Nathan MacKinnon goes. He is hot, though. I mean, it's hard to say against him. I mean, the goal he had in overtime in Game 2, it was a remarkable shot. It was,
oh my goodness,
looked like it was about 200-mile-an-hour wrist shot over Mike Smith's glove that he probably blinked and could have missed. I know I certainly could have because it was just remarkable. That game was close. Game 3, I believe, was a blowout for the Avalanche. I forget the margin of victory, but it certainly wasn't a close game, if I recall correctly. And
6-2.
So yeah, 6-2, that's not going to... Yeah, nobody is going to enjoy that very much unless you're a Colorado Avalanche fan.
Shots were 56-29 in favor of the Avalanche in that game.
56?
That's right.
Oh, that's bad. That's really right. Bad because Calgary has all 3 of their defensive pairings were top 10 as far as Corsi ranking goes. I saw that stat last week. 56. Ah, that makes me sweat having Calgary in my bracket. But my bracket's blown. We'll get to that in a little bit later.
No kidding.
One more series in the West that is going, I think, a little bit more predictably, at least as far as I'm concerned. It's Vegas and San Jose. Vegas currently has a 3-1 series lead. San Jose looks like a shell of their former selves. Marc-Andre Fleury had a shutout in Game 4, his 15th career postseason shutout, so congrats to Flower there. Second line for Vegas, 28 points through the first 4 games. That's a line composed of Mark Stone, Max Pacioretty, and who am I forgetting? The Paul Stastny?
It might be Paul Stastny.
I believe, that's the 3 people that make up the quote-unquote second line. They have 28 points regardless. Every other player on Vegas is combined for 21. So talk about living and dying by a line. This line has certainly been the only lifeblood for them. But when Mark Stone is getting hat tricks in the playoffs, which is the first for Vegas in their short 2-year history, it will get the job done surely.
What blows my mind in this series is not that Vegas has a 3-1 lead, but is that the winner has scored 5 or 6 goals in all 4 of these games. If my memory serves me well, I believe last year Vegas swept LA in the first round by a score of 7-4 combined.
Yeah, it was very small margin.
And
they're
putting up roughly 5 goals a night through 4 games so far. So you talked about Fleury with the shutout. That's more what I expect from Vegas. 5 goals in a game is not necessarily what I expect from Vegas.
And in Game 3, they had a sequence where at the beginning of each period, within the first minute, Vegas scored a goal.
Yes.
Like, what the heck is that? Talk about coming out
That's tough
on
to
fire.
Overcome if you're the San Jose Sharks.
It's tough to overcome if you're any team in the National Hockey League. Whenever you let the team come out of the locker room and immediately they're ready to play, certainly puts a lot on your back, especially last game. Martin Jones was removed after, I believe, gave up two shots or two goals on less than 10 shots. Not ideal. They put in Aaron Dell. He obviously did no better, but once again, they scored zero. Is this series over? Is it Vegas's to lose?
I won't go that far yet, but what I will say is that their home ice advantage in Vegas is incredible. As you would expect, Vegas knows how to put on a show. It's fantastic, and I expect the Sharks to win this next one at their place, but go back to Vegas, it's going to be a little bit tougher.
Yeah, definitely going to be tough there, so that's what the West looks like. Moving over to the East, there's only two to talk about in action because there are two that are unfortunately over. I'm going to start with the two in action. It is Toronto and Boston. This series, we said in the West how the Nashville series is back and forth, so is to Winnipeg. Well, Toronto and Boston have decided to just alternate wins and just, I guess they're going to flip a coin for Game 7 because Toronto is up 2-1 right now in the series. But Boston certainly has every opportunity to come back, and I believe they're playing right now. What's the score we got?
4-2 Boston at the end of the second period. That period just ended.
Right, so if that serves the rest of the game, obviously it will be a 2-2 series, suddenly becoming a best of three. One, I guess it's a big loss for Toronto. I really wouldn't consider it to be one. Nazem Kadri, he was suspended for a horrific cross-check to the face, which has no place in any way, shape, or form. He is suspended the rest of the series, thank God. So he's an okay player, I guess. Not really someone that I care for too much. I don't think it's that big of a impact. But from Boston, it certainly is, all right, this guy, you know, attacked us with his stick. Well, let's get back at them in the series. So kind of some motivation there, I think.
Yeah, Nazem Kadri is a significant piece of that team as far as I'm concerned. It's just a shame that sometimes guys are too stupid for their own good. Other players come to mind, but Nazem Kadri is right up there with them. A very skilled player, but at times just loses their mind for whatever reason, and it got him kicked out of the rest of the series. Maybe the playoffs, depending on how this goes. So not a smart move at all, or a clean move by Nazem Kadri.
No, and each of these three games have been pretty one-sided for the team that's won, which makes it even odder that the series is going back and forth in the way it is. Usually, like the other series, Nashville and Dallas, we saw all one-goal games. Well, this one, all the margins of victory have been, I believe, two or three goals. There really haven't been that many close calls at all. I believe Game 3 was a 3-2, but the first two games were 4-1 each way. Boston and Toronto split. So it's not really been tremendously close, but at the same point, it's been extraordinarily close. Interesting to see how that one develops. Another one that I'm really interested to see how it develops, it's Washington and Carolina. Washington has a 2-1 series lead, but the storm surge in Carolina is something to behold. Washington did go up 2-0 in the series. First game, they won handily. It really wasn't a contest. Second game, however, took overtime after Carolina made a remarkable third period comeback. Washington was able to get the upper hand thanks to, of all people, Brooks Orpik scored the overtime winner. Why not? Because playoff hockey makes no sense. And then Game 3, we went to Carolina, their first hockey game in the playoffs in about 10 years. So all the fans were very eager on the edges of their seat, and the Hurricanes also were as they came out and blew the doors off the Capitals with a 5-0 victory. More of that to come or more of the first two games to come? What are your thoughts?
Oh, boy. Just for the sake of an entertaining series, I hope at least Game 4 has more of what we saw in Game 3. In Washington, the Capitals outscore this team 8-5. In Carolina, it's 0-5 in favor of the Hurricanes. It's fantastic, incredible to see the difference between games 1 and 2 and then game 3. I kind of expected some energy, some enthusiasm, and a win for the Hurricanes, but not like that. I'm excited to see what happens. Quick note, back to the Dallas game, 4-0 now.
Oof. Looks like that one's going to be 2-2 as well. So we went over six series, but there's still two more unaccounted for. Well, that's because two teams decided that they want to get their brooms out and sweep away their opponents in swift fashion. But of course, they are not as anybody expected. I will start at home with the Islanders and Penguins series. Oh, okay, the Penguins won 4-0 like they had in years past, another cup. Incorrect. The Barry Trotz led Islanders just completely shut down the Penguins in a 4-0 series sweep. It was not really that close at all. First game did go to overtime, was a 4-3 victory for the Islanders, but each of the other three games, the Penguins were only able to muster one goal in each one for a combined six goals over four games. Gives me haunting flashbacks to the 2013 conference final against the Bruins, not quite as bad, but certainly was not a good, strong effort from the Penguins by any means.
There were moments in this series where the Penguins looked like they didn't want to be out on the ice.
And I didn't want them to be either.
And it cost them. But even in the moments where they were playing good hockey or looked like the momentum was in their favor, the Islanders had an answer. And I think historically in the playoffs, we've seen teams like the Islanders be able to use their defense to shut down offensively gifted teams, whether or not it makes sense. And not what I expected, not what I think a lot of people expected, but kudos to the Islanders. They have their game plan, they stuck to it, and whether or not the Penguins were there to play, it worked for them. So the Islanders will be a tough test for whoever comes out of that Washington and Carolina series.
Yeah, especially when you look at a guy like Jordan Eberle, who was given up on by the Todd McClellan-led Oilers, now scored 4 goals in the series against the Penguins. Brock Nelson and Josh Bailey, household names for me, but probably not for most in the NHL because nobody really pays that much attention to the Islanders. Well, each of them had 3 goals in the series as well. So, yes, these guys aren't the Connor McDavids, the Sidney Crosbys, the Nathan MacKinnons of the league, but these are the guys that the Islanders rely on, and the guys they rely on were able to get the job done, whereas the Penguins relied on Jake Guentzel, Sidney Crosby, Evgeny Malkin, Phil Kessel. Crosby without a goal, and Kessel, Malkin, and Guentzel all combined to have 1 goal each. Matt Murray didn't play bad exactly, but whenever you only score 1 goal in 3 different games,
it's tough.
Yeah, you're not going to get anything done by any means. I mean, credit to Barry Trotz. He is an excellent coach. Do not care for the guy. Excellent coach. Can really get his defense to shape it up. Obviously, last year, Washington's defense was good. We've seen them now give up more goals to Carolina than they would like. And then the Islanders have their game plan stuck to it. So big kudos to them. Another team that stuck to their game plan, I have no idea how. It's the Columbus Blue Jackets, led by John Tortorella. They swept Tampa Bay Lightning. Swept them. Tampa Bay, 128 points, 62 wins. Columbus Blue Jackets, last team to get in the playoffs in the East. A team that we had wrote off many times in the year because of John Tortorella. Swept the Lightning. I'm stunned. There's no other way to put it.
Chris, I've never been more surprised by a playoff outcome in my life. This is incredible. I have no words. I really don't know what to say about it. Tampa Bay at the beginning of game one looked like they were going to run away with the game, maybe even the series.
We're up 3-0 in the first period.
Columbus had different ideas.
Entirely different.
From the moment that they scored that first goal, Tampa Bay was never really in the series again. It's interesting. I could have expected a Columbus victory somewhere along the line against a different team. But against a team that swept them in the regular season, against a team that is more talented than they are, and Columbus has some talent on that roster, but Tampa Bay matches it, exceeds it. The best team that we've seen in hockey in our lifetimes, and they were absolutely lifeless in the first round. It blows my mind. Nikita Kucherov got himself suspended. I don't know that he had more than a handful of points in this series.
Nobody stood out on the Lightning.
I don't know where the Lightning go from here. I liked them last year. I liked them this year. I don't know what's next for them. I think it's going to take some time to really stop and look, take a good hard look in the mirror. I don't know where they go from here.
Yeah, after they went up 3-0 in game one, they were outscored by the Blue Jackets 19-5. Now, 3 of those goals were empty net goals in game four, the deciding game, so take away those 3. It's still a 16-5 margin. I mean, the Blue Jackets didn't squeak by. They handily beat the Lightning. Games 2 and 3 were all Columbus. Game 4 was much more back and forth. Game 1 was much more back and forth. But after the first period, basically from period 2 of game 1 all the way up until game 4, it was all Columbus. Tampa Bay had no answer. In my opinion, John Cooper has to go. You can't lead a team to 62 victories, the tied for the most in regular season history, 128 points, and just get swept in the first round. It's the first time the President's Trophy winner has ever been swept, ever. There's been a President's Trophy since the 80s. I mean, there's been one seeds that have lost before, but it's incredible. I don't know.
It's incredible, and it got us thinking. And when we get to thinking, Top Takeover comes about. And when Top Takeover comes about, we have some fun. So the biggest playoff collapses in the history of the NHL and NBA. Chris, do you want to lead it off?
I will. I will start with the NBA. It's at my number 5. It is the 2006-2007 Dallas Mavericks. That was the year that Dirk Nowitzki won his first and only MVP for the team. They were the best team in the West, had a 67-15 record. Remarkable team. Well, they decided to lose to the Golden State Warriors. No, not the Steph Curry Golden State Warriors. The Baron Davis Golden State Warriors. They lost the first round 4-2. They were the third number one seed to ever lose in the first round. So that shows the lack of disparity in the NBA. It's pretty much a top-heavy league. And the Mavericks to lose in the way they did was really remarkable. That's why their collapse goes to number five on my list.
Number five on my list is in the National Hockey League 2010. The Montreal Canadiens knock off the Washington Capitals. The Capitals, 54 wins and 121 points, a very dominating season. Montreal, 39, 33, and 10 with 88 points, barely even getting to the playoffs. 88 points in the Western Conference would have been good for 12th place, so not a great Montreal team, but Washington's 3-1 series lead would not hold up. The Canadiens went on to win the next three behind Yaroslav Halak. The Capitals went 1-for-30 on the power play in this series, and Halak made 94 of 96 saves in games 6 through 7. That level of dominance, that level of collapse blows my mind. That's my number five.
Boy, as a Penguins fan, that brings a smile on my face. My number four will stay in the National Hockey League, move to the Western Conference. It was a 2016-17 Chicago Blackhawks, a team I picked to win the Stanley Cup that season. They decided to do otherwise and get swept by the Nashville Predators in the first round. The Blackhawks did not win the President's Trophy. They were the one seed in the West, however, so the second best team in the National Hockey League. It was the first time a one was swept by an eight ever in playoff history. And that was a Nashville Predators team that did end up making the Stanley Cup final that year. Obviously lost, but they were a good team. But still, to get swept in the first round, be the first one too, when so many people had you picked as the Cup favorite. It's hard, but hey, that's why they're my number four on the playoff collapses.
That's a good one. My number four is in the NBA, and we're throwing it back to 1994 when the Nuggets upset the Seattle Supersonics. Seattle was 63-19, best record in the NBA. Denver got in at 42-40, very average. Games 1 and 2 went Seattle's way by a total of 34 points, as you would expect. Denver, though, in Game 3 won by 17 points. Overall, it comes back to Seattle, who has the best home record. They end up losing at home. It was the first time a number 8 knocked off a number 1 in the NBA. A dominating team, dominant at home, loses at home to a team that was barely 500. Good for number 4 on my list.
My number 3 is going to be in the NBA, and it also refers to a team that lost at home. It may be interesting to include them, but I have to. It's the Golden State Warriors of 2015-16 when they set the record with NBA wins at 73-9. Well, Chris, how are you going to include them in playoff collapses? They led the league in wins. Well, they lost the finals. They were up 3-1 to the Cleveland Cavaliers, and they let them come back and win 4-3. It is, and their final Game 7 was at Oracle Arena in Golden State. They lost to the Cavs. I mean, it's a team that should have done better. Even in their Western Conference final, they were down 3-1 to the Thunder, actually, and they had to come back, which was remarkable in itself that they were even down. But they were still the Golden State Warriors. They were the reigning NBA champions, and for the fact that they let the Cavaliers come back from a 3-1 deficit, it's remarkable. That's why that's number three on my top list of collapses.
Number three for me is what we just talked about, the Tampa Bay Lightning and the Columbus Blue Jackets. I won't go into too much detail because we've already done that, but it's the first series win for Columbus ever. Tampa Bay is the first President's Trophy winner to be swept. They had the fourth most points in a season ever and tied the most wins ever in a season. It's incredible to me. The only reason it's not higher is Columbus had 98 points. A good team in their own right, but regardless, baffling to me at number three.
My number two will be a one that you brought up before. It's the 2009-2010 Washington Capitals. It was just the way, yes, they were up 3-1, they lost 4-3. So, okay, they won three games, but just how it happened. Being up 3-1, okay, they're a team that President's Trophy winner. They're going to steamroll. They're going to get the job done. Well, clearly they couldn't. There was a 33-point gap between the Capitals and the Canadiens. That is the fifth largest ever in postseason history. I don't know if that's like the largest that there is or the largest to lose. I would assume fifth largest ever, but still, the fact that they let them come back led by Yaroslav Halak, it's weird. It's my number two because it still brings a smile to my face as a Penguins fan to see them lose so well, but my number two.
My number two is that 2007 Warriors-Mavericks series that you talked about, not only because it was an odd loss, a 67-win Mavericks team, but just the fashion that it was in. The series was 4-2, but Golden State won on average by 10 points, which is dominant for a team that was 42-40 in the regular season. For the Mavericks, it was the first time ever that a team with 65 or more wins lost in the first round, so that is my number two.
My number one is one that we've all talked about, so on all of everybody's mind. It's this year's Tampa Bay Lightning. It's just, there's so many different factors. Yes, Columbus never won a series. Yes, Tampa Bay, 62 wins, 128 points, President's Trophy. All these things throw into a pot. What do you get? A 4-0 sweep from Columbus, apparently. It still blows my mind. I don't know when I'll be able to come to terms with it. Hopefully sooner than John Cooper can, and that's my number one.
My number one throws it all the way back to 1982 in the National Hockey League.
1982.
The LA Kings knock off the Edmonton Oilers. The Oilers were 48-17-15 for 111 points. The Kings, 24-41-15 for 63 points. That Edmonton team, Wayne Gretzky, Mark Messier, Paul Coffey, among others, not much to brag about in Los Angeles. But in Game 4, the Oilers are up 5-0 in the second period. That's cut to 5-3 with 5 minutes to go. A five-minute major to the Oilers gives the LA Kings another goal. And then with 5 seconds to play, they tie the game. Darrell Evans scores in overtime to win the game for Los Angeles. Game 5 goes to Edmonton. At this point, it was a best of five. LA takes it. That's incredible. That's my number one.
Wow. I never knew that happened. And that was right before the Oilers start their dominance. That's 24-win team.
Incredible. Now we got to go super quick to quick picks. We're just going to fly through these, Chris. Flames at Avs, they play tonight. Who you got?
I got the Flames. They can't go down 3-1. It has to be Calgary.
I have the Flames as well. Blues at Jets, I'm going with the Blues. Road team's going to keep it up.
Absolutely. I'm going with the Blues for the same reason. Golden Knights at Sharks. Golden Knights are going to take the series in 5. I got them over the Sharks.
Sharks are going to keep off elimination. They're going to take it in their building. 76ers at Nets. Sixers are going to go on top.
I think it's going to be the Nets. Home team reigns supreme. Same thought process for next one. Nuggets at Spurs. Spurs have it. Nuggets don't.
32-9 at home. I'm going Spurs. Warriors at Clippers. I'm going to take the Warriors. The urgency's got
to
be there, Chris.
Yeah, you can't fight against the Warriors, and the Clippers certainly won't be able to either. I got the Golden State Warriors as well.
One Major League Baseball series. Dodgers at Brewers. 4-game set. I'm going to go with the Brewers to actually win that series. They're playing well at home.
I'm going to go with the Brewers and a 3-1 victory in that 4-game set.
Same here. That is all the time that we have. Thanks to everybody for tuning in. And be sure to check out Sports Takeover on social media for more content that you may not see on here on the show. Until next time, good night, everyone.